and now three perspectives from medical oncology. First, Dr. Greg Riley, part of the lung cancer team at Memorial that has done so much to further translational research, particularly the fascinating field of biomarkers to predict sensitivity to EGFR TKIs. To begin, Dr. Riley reviewed the background for this work.
This story really begins with the observation that a number of patients who were treated with gefitinib and erlotinib in early studies had remarkable responses to therapy with erlotinib and gefitinib. When we initially started looking at these patients, actually Vince Miller was one of the lead authors in this work, as well as Mark Criss in looking at the IDEAL studies. What we've noted is that patients who responded were more likely to be patients who never smoked cigarettes. They were more likely to be patients who had adenocarcinoma histologies. And among those patients with adenocarcinoma histologies were more likely to have the bronchoalveolar type of adenocarcinoma. And so that led to sort of a clinical fingerprint of the type of patient who would be most likely to respond. But we didn't understand the molecular underpinnings of this. Then in 2004, three groups essentially simultaneously reported on patients who had responded to both gefitinib and erlotinib and identified that those patients all shared somatic mutations in the epidermal growth factor receptor. And when I say somatic mutation, what I'm talking about is a mutation that's in the tumor. It's not in peripheral blood as a general rule. It's not in other tissues of the body. It's only in the lung cancer tumor. These patients who responded, most of them had EGFR mutation in their tumor, and among patients who did not respond, most of them did not have an EGFR mutation, really making it relatively clear that this is one of the molecular underpinnings of response to gefitinib and erlotinib. Later work has actually gone on to show, and I think it's very interesting, and it really cements for me the relationship between EGFR mutations and lung cancer and the response to therapy. Interesting work has shown that if you take those EGFR mutations and you put them in mice, those mice develop lung cancer tumors that are dependent on that EGFR signaling. So you can put a mutation, mutant EGFR, into a mouse, it develops a lung tumor. And then you can either turn off EGFR through erlotinib, gefitinib, or any of a number of molecular mechanisms and stop that lung cancer tumor from growing and, in fact, cause it to regress very quickly.
What's the current understanding about sort of the pathophysiology or pathopharmacology, what's going on? I remember in the beginning there was this idea that in some way it had to do with the way the TKI fits in there.
Yeah, the initial thought was that the mutations allowed erlotinib or gefitinib to somehow better fit in the ATP binding groove of EGFR. And I think that that's probably not the case. I think that the mutations really serve as a marker for those tumors which are dependent on EGFR as a mechanism for tumorigenesis and tumor maintenance. So by inhibiting that particular protein, you're able to inhibit the tumor itself. And that leads to concepts like oncogene addiction, the thought that these tumors are addicted to the EGFR oncogene. The other idea is that this is the Achilles heel of these tumors.
What do we know about EGFR antibodies in these patients? There's been a lot of talk, and you and I all talk about cetuximab, but what do we know about that?
You know, it's actually relatively little knowledge about this group of patients in treatment with cetuximab. There's a fair amount of animal data, but there's relatively little known about taking, you know, as we've seen many studies now that have taken patients who only have EGFR mutations and treating those patients with gefitinib or erlotinib and seeing these remarkable response rates, 80%+ response rates. But we don't have similar data for cetuximab or panitumumab, the other EGFR antibody. And I think that even looking at the larger studies which treated unselected patients, we haven't seen those remarkable single-agent responses. So these antibodies may very well not work for those patients.
What are some of the other markers that have been studied, particularly FISH, in terms of predicting response to the EGFR TKIs?
Right. So trying to understand what patients respond to EGFR TKIs and trying to understand the molecular marker that is the key one has been a very complicated field for the past few years. The three most common markers that people talk about are epidermal growth factor receptor protein. So this is IHC, which is your standard IHC test that every pathology lab in America does. Then another one that people look at is something called EGFR FISH. FISH stands for fluorescence in situ hybridization. And what you're looking at there is gene copy number. In patients with lung cancer, it's rare to see EGFR gene amplification like you see with HER2 and breast cancer. But instead, what you see is an elevation in the number of copies. So instead of having two copies, which we all have, these patients have in their tumors, you know, four, five, six copies, maybe three copies in some cells. And it leads to a description of what we call FISH positive or FISH negative without really being true amplification. And then as we talked about, EGFR mutations are the other side of the story. There have been a fair number of retrospective evaluations of large tumor sets from large randomized trials looking at EGFR immunohistochemistry, EGFR FISH, and EGFR mutation. And I think it gets complicated, but what I would break it down to is that I think it's really a sensitivity specificity type issue in that patients with EGFR immunohistochemistry positive tumors actually represent the majority of lung cancer tumors, and these patients may or may not respond, and it doesn't really serve as much of an enrichment for patients likely to respond to erlotinib. Then if you look at EGFR FISH, it seems like fewer patients have the true FISH positive tumor. But among those patients with FISH-positive tumors, the response rate is much higher than we all know the unselected patient populations. The response rates to erlotinib are about 9%. If you pick out the FISH-positive ones, that response rate jumps significantly, closer to 40%. And then with the EGFR mutations, those patients represented a very uncommon patient with lung cancer. Only about 10% of patients with lung cancer have these EGFR mutations. But the response rate for those tumors is closer to 80%. So I think that's how I put together in my mind these various predictors of response to therapy, is that the EGFR mutation represents the most specific one, whereas EGFR FISH and IHC describe a larger number of patients, but they're less likely to respond.
Now, can you explain again how you get increased copy number, but it's not, quote, amplification?
Right. So true amplification would likely be observed in every cell in the tumor or the majority of cells in the tumor and would always be at least four or six copies per cell. In EGFR FISH positive tumors, it's a complicated scoring system that really looks at the number of cells with four or more copies, the number of cells with between two and four copies, and kind of puts it all together to describe a positive and negative group.
Now, you know, it's been interesting to me to see this evolve, and yet when I first heard about it, I assumed that these kinds of assays, particularly the mutation, would be done on every specimen. Just like with breast cancer, you know, you get ER/HER2, every time you get a piece of tissue, you're going to study it. And surprisingly, you know, I guess maybe 4 years later, it really doesn't seem to be done very much in community practice.
I think there are two real difficult things there that make it hard for that to happen. One is the amount of tissue. In breast cancer, it's easy to get a large chunk of tissue. In fact, most of our patients with advanced breast cancer once had localized breast cancer, and there is a piece of tissue sitting in a pathology lab somewhere. For patients with lung cancer, the majority of them present with metastatic disease, and the most common biopsy done is a fine needle aspiration where you have a handful of cells on one single slide that identifies the tumor. Occasionally, a core biopsy is done or a somewhat larger specimen is obtained, and you have a fair amount of tissue there, but oftentimes part of that specimen is used up doing immunohistochemistry looking to identify the origin of the tumor and that sort of thing. And so when you want to do an EGFR mutation test, you need a relatively large amount of tissue. And what I use as a rule of thumb is you need about 10 to 15 unstained slides to do EGFR mutation testing. And I think the second big barrier to getting this done routinely is that this sequencing or tumor or mutation testing is not done in every pathology lab in America. And it's not something that can easily be scaled to the average pathology department. And as such, it's sort of destined to become a send-out test for all of those departments. Right now, Genzyme does molecular testing for most of the country, and they are really the leaders in this area. But they see relatively small numbers of specimens compared to the nearly 200,000 patients who are diagnosed with lung cancer each year.
What are the clinical trials right now that are open to patients who are either non-smokers or have the mutation?
There's one major trial going on, and that's the RADIANT trial. And that takes patients with stage 1 through 3 non-small cell lung cancer who had resection, complete resection of their tumor, and they have their tumor tested by immunohistochemistry and have EGFR, IHC, or FISH performed. And those patients are randomized to erlotinib or placebo. And it's a 2-year course of the erlotinib or placebo. And the primary endpoint for this trial is an overall survival endpoint.
And what other studies are being done?
And then probably the other study is a trial that is being led by Alicia Sequist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and we're also collaborating with, where patients are identified to go onto the trial as only those patients with EGFR mutations. And this is not a randomized trial. This one is just a trial comparing the outcome in these patients to historical controls. And only patients with EGFR mutations go onto this trial, and they all receive erlotinib.
Why is it that there isn't an adjuvant trial right now where a primary inclusion criteria is EGFR mutation?
That's a good question. I think that this would be an important trial to develop in the United States. I think that it would be very useful. You're well aware of all the issues associated with adjuvant trials and that they're complicated to carry out, and the outcomes are long-term outcomes, making it somewhat more difficult to carry these trials out. But I think that it's an important idea for a trial, and I think it should happen. Hopefully it will happen.
What about the issue of non-protocol management and the adjuvant setting of a patient with a known mutation? Obviously, we don't have data. In a way, it sort of sounds like I'm not sure we are going to have data. How do you approach these patients? Do you offer, for example, erlotinib off-study to them?
You know, I think that that's a really difficult question. I think you're right to think about the ethics of the situation. When I approach a patient where I'm deciding on adjuvant therapy, I think about how we've decided on what adjuvant treatments to administer to patients with lung cancer. You know, the best data for lung cancer patients is with cisplatin-based doublet chemotherapy as the adjuvant therapy of choice. And why did we study that treatment? We chose that treatment because that's the treatment that has the best response rate in stage 4 disease. It shows the best outcomes for patients with stage 4 disease. And so, you know, when we look at that, you say response rate is high, then we're going to translate that into the adjuvant setting. And so I think that it's hard to argue with the idea of using a drug with a response rate of 80%+, that is erlotinib, in a patient with an EGFR mutation. It's hard to argue with using that therapy in a patient with a resected non-small cell lung cancer. I think some of the difficulty gets back to the idea of whether this represents a predictive factor or a prognostic factor. Some retrospective analyses of patients with EGFR mutation tumors have shown that they do relatively well after resection in comparison to EGFR wild-type tumors. And as such, these patients may go on to do better overall, no matter whether we give them erlotinib or not. And so I think that that sort of raises the difficult issue in my mind of whether a patient should take this drug, is because they may do well overall without getting something. But at the same time, I know that lung cancer is a bad disease, and recurrence rates for patients with even stage 1 lung cancer are 60% or greater. And as such, I generally would like to recommend to my patients that they do everything they can. And so when I have a conversation with a patient with early stage resected lung cancer who has a known EGFR mutation, I sit down with them and I explain to them that there's no data showing improvements in overall survival. I explain to them that there's no outcome data to say that treating with erlotinib will help, but it's my scientific best guess that treatment with erlotinib will improve overall survival for these patients.
I guess the other issue is that you're at least not looking at, you know, potentially fatal or very serious complications. Erlotinib is not necessarily an easy drug to use, particularly if you're going to use it for a long time. But you do have that to fall back on, the fact that there's really not much in the way of serious complications.
Yeah, I think the main serious side effect is the interstitial lung disease, which is a relatively uncommon side effect in the United States, but it's a real one. And I think that, you know, one that every doctor using this drug needs to know about and needs to talk with their patient about.
When you talk to your patients about it, what kind of numbers do you give them about the risk?
I note that interstitial lung disease is approximately 1% of patients in the United States who get treated with erlotinib.
And then the patient says, what happens? What's the usual outcome?
The outcome can vary, but the most serious outcome is death from interstitial lung disease. The more common outcome is patients identify their reaction early and are treated with high-dose steroids, and we are able to support them through it.
What about the issue of these patients with mutations in terms of metastatic disease and, you know, sort of where erlotinib fits in? Do you generally use it upfront or chemotherapy?
I think that you can make a perfectly reasonable argument for treating patients with known mutations or with clinical characteristics that are likely to be associated with mutations, such as never smokers with adenocarcinomas. You can make a strong argument to begin those patients with erlotinib monotherapy, and that's what I do generally in an off-study situation. I think that we're also studying a large number of next-generation EGFR inhibitors, things that are irreversible inhibitors, drugs that hit both EGFR and VEGF in those patient populations as well. But in an off-study situation, I think it's reasonable to approach those patients with either erlotinib monotherapy or, as in the CALGB trial that's ongoing, erlotinib with conventional chemotherapy.
So let's take the next step in terms of sort of the new biology of lung cancer and talk a little bit about the FLEX study that was presented at ASCO looking at chemotherapy and cetuximab. Can you summarize what they looked at and what they found?
So in the FLEX study, patients were randomized to receive either cisplatin-vinorelbine or cisplatin-vinorelbine with cetuximab. Patients received cetuximab on a weekly basis, and after 6 cycles of chemotherapy, those patients who were on cetuximab continued cetuximab as a maintenance therapy, really in an analogous trial used to identify bevacizumab as an effective therapy in non-small cell lung cancer. And what the data shows is that there is an improvement in overall survival without a marked difference in progression-free survival for patients treated with cetuximab. The improvement in overall survival is on the order of 1 month. And I think that at ASCO, we saw a number of pieces of data about subset analyses looking at Asian patients, non-Asian patients, squamous cell carcinomas, adenocarcinomas. And I think that that really gets to our usage of these drugs because in patients with squamous cell tumors, we're not able to use bevacizumab in a safe fashion. And you know, when they looked at the subset analysis in FLEX, they noted that cetuximab was equally efficacious in squamous cell tumors as in adenocarcinomas, and as such, it would be a reasonable choice for those patients.
Now, this study also had as an entry criteria IHC positivity, quote, end quote. Can you talk about that?
So in order to include patients in this trial, they had to have evidence of essentially one cell that was immunohistochemistry positive for epidermal growth factor receptor. So extraordinarily low bar for patients to go onto this trial. And I think that, you know, in our experience with cetuximab in colorectal cancer, we really learned that EGFR staining is not an important factor for predicting which patients are going to benefit from cetuximab in colorectal cancer. And I think it's unlikely to be a real predictor for patients with lung cancer as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because Tom Lynch, who did the discussion of the FLEX trial at ASCO, was saying that he had received a call from your colleague, Len Saltz, who really went through that whole thing with the IHC and cetuximab. And we actually interviewed him as the data was coming out. And he was just, I guess, relating his experience and, I guess, caution about that whole thing.
Right, absolutely. I think that it's clear to me that cetuximab does not require EGFR IHC positive tumors to work.
What about KRAS? Obviously, there's a lot of interest in colon cancer. What do we know about KRAS and cetuximab and non-small cell?
So KRAS as an indicator of response to therapy in non-small cell lung cancer is in some ways ahead of the colorectal cancer world, but in also other ways behind the colorectal cancer world. And let me explain that. So we actually identified in 2005 that patients with KRAS mutations were more likely to have primary resistance to erlotinib or gefitinib. So really noting whenever anybody shows you the EGFR schematic of signaling, you see that the epidermal growth factor receptor is up on the surface of the cell and that of all those signaling molecules that are downstream of EGFR, KRAS is one of them. And so we hypothesized that, well, you know, if there's a mutation in KRAS, it ain't going to matter how you modulate the epidermal growth factor receptor, whether you treat it with an antibody, whether you treat it with a small molecule inhibitor, it's not going to affect that tumor's ability to respond to the activated KRAS. And so when we looked initially, we identified no erlotinib or gefitinib responders with KRAS mutations. And of the patients who didn't respond to erlotinib or gefitinib, we found that about 20% of them had KRAS mutations. And so that really marked it for us as a marker of primary resistance. So we've gone on in a number of other studies from our institution and then also from the BR21 data from Canada. People have looked at, as well as a whole host of other groups, have looked at KRAS mutations as a predictor of primary resistance to erlotinib or gefitinib monotherapy. And it's relatively clear that presence of KRAS mutation means that patients aren't going to respond to erlotinib or gefitinib. Where we are behind in the lung cancer world compared to the colorectal cancer world is an understanding whether that holds true for cetuximab therapy. As you've probably reviewed with others, the colorectal cancer world has done a marvelous job of correlating KRAS mutations to absence of response to cetuximab. They've done it both in monotherapy trials as well as in randomized trials where patients are treated with chemotherapy or chemotherapy plus cetuximab, demonstrating that KRAS is not a prognostic factor, at least it's not a prognostic factor for treatment with conventional chemotherapy, but that it does predict absence of response to cetuximab and panitumumab. So hopefully we're going to see similar data on the tumor material available from FLEX so that we can establish that same story in non-small cell lung cancer. I don't think anybody would be surprised to hear that it is the same story.
So do you right now utilize KRAS in deciding whether to use erlotinib?
We do. Like I mentioned earlier, on every resected non-small cell lung cancer specimen, we do KRAS and EGFR mutation testing so that should that patient have recurrence of disease, we know their mutation status up front. And in patients who have sufficient material at the time of diagnosis of stage 4 disease, we do both EGFR and KRAS mutation testing. We do it in a staged fashion at our institution right now where we check for EGFR mutation, and if that's not present, then we go on to do KRAS mutation testing. However, we're actually changing our assays for KRAS and EGFR mutation testing so that they will be done in a parallel fashion in the near future.
So are there tumors that are KRAS mutant and EGFR mutated?
I think those tumors are extraordinarily rare. We've seen reports of those in the literature, though we've never identified one like that at our institution, and hundreds of tumors where we've checked for both. And I think biologically, it wouldn't really make sense to have both an EGFR and a KRAS mutation because the EGFR is sufficient to cause a tumor and the KRAS mutation is sufficient to cause a tumor, and the tumor would have no interest in having two tumorigenic mutations.
So in terms of cetuximab, is that putting aside regulatory reimbursement issues but just sticking with this clinical science right now, based on what you've seen with that, do you think that that's sort of a positive risk-benefit ratio for, let's say, a patient has squamous cell? Let's sort of remove Bev from the equation for the moment.
Right. I think it's a reasonable thing to consider for patients with a squamous cell tumor. And the conversation I have with patients is understanding that there are a number of lines of therapy and that all therapy does not have to occur in the first line and that it's, you know, multiple chapters of a book type of idea. But I talk with them about whether they want to approach this treatment up front with as many therapies as possible and discuss the side effect profile. The side effects of cetuximab are real. They range from the rash that we see to the side effect that a lot of people don't talk about, which is that it's a weekly therapy. Patients are ending up coming to the doctor's office once a week, essentially for the first six cycles of therapy, which is a lot of time in a doctor's office for a patient with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer. So I have that conversation with patients, and I have to say that I've only administered cetuximab to one patient in the time since the ASCO data came out.
So you've had people who didn't want to take
it? Right, exactly. I think that I talk with them about it, and they are not interested in having the rash. And I also talk with them about the reported benefit. You know, the improvements in overall survival are relatively modest, and it's hard for patients to get their heads around the idea that they're going to have something that causes them side effects without a marked benefit.
Now, what about the choice of chemotherapy with cetuximab?
I think that you can make the argument that it's reasonable to use cetuximab with most of our standard platinum-based doublets. The FLEX trial used cisplatin-vinorelbine. Certainly, that's a widely used therapy in Europe. It's not a widely used therapy in the United States by any means. But we do have a fair amount of safety data demonstrating that it's okay to use cetuximab with gemcitabine cisplatin. That's the Canadian study led by Butts. And we also have safety data showing that carboplatin paclitaxel is safe to give with cetuximab, and that's a trial led by Tom Lynch. So I think that these are safe combinations, and as such, it's reasonable to do that.
What about panitumumab? What do we know about that in lung cancer?
So the data for panitumumab is not really there for non-small cell lung cancer. I think that the company has decided not to pursue that, or at least as of a year ago or so, had decided not to pursue this, you know, evaluating panitumumab in lung cancer. I think as a direct analogy with the colorectal world, it seems reasonable to think it would be effective, but there's no significant data to point us one way or the other.
Now, what about the patient with an adenocarcinoma who meets the entry criteria for the ECOG 4599 study looking at carboplatin and bevacizumab? How do you approach those patients, and do you think that chemocetuximab is an option in this situation?
I think chemocetuximab is an option, but at the same time, we do know that carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab led to a 2-month improvement in overall survival as compared to a somewhat less improvement in overall survival for the FLEX data. And as such, I think it's reasonable to think that bevacizumab is probably superior, though, you know, that's comparing cross trials and the usual caveats that apply. But that's also combined with our greater experience with administering bevacizumab for a large number of patients.
What's your take on the potential risks of bevacizumab to the patient with lung cancer, and how do you go through that with your patients?
I think that it's important to discuss these risks with patients because they're real and they can be quite dramatic if it occurs. I talk with all my patients about the risks of thromboembolic events with bevacizumab because I think that's an important one. You know, stroke is a debilitating side effect when it occurs, and as such, patients all need to hear about that.
What kind of numbers do you give to your patients?
You know, I think that I generally avoid specific numbers on this one because the data is not as well collated as it is perhaps for the colorectal cancer patient, but I think that I say in the single-digit percentages, patients are more likely to have stroke or heart attack or other events like that. And then I also talk with them about hemoptysis and fatal hemoptysis because that is an important cause of death with patients who are treated with bevacizumab. Those numbers are on the order of 3 to 5% is what I tell patients.
Are there any sort of risk factors for hemoptysis that you feel are useful to you in trying to sort through the risk?
Well, certainly squamous histology is a bad one, and evidence of cavitation of the tumor pre-treatment is also something that I look at and drives me away from using bevacizumab in that setting. I think that central tumor is one we talk about a lot, but it's not really well defined. I take a look at the scan. I look and see if there's a tumor sort of abutting large vessels that are important, and that's sort of my poor man's look at what a central tumor represents.
What's your experience been with other sort of more day-to-day side effects like hypertension and proteinuria?
Hypertension hasn't been, to my mind, a relatively significant problem. I think it occurs, certainly, but most of us are board-certified internists, and I think we can try to manage hypertension at least a little bit, and there's such a wide variety of antihypertensives out there that we can certainly choose one and begin that therapy. As we were taught back in internal medicine residency programs, I've decided to pick a class of agents and become comfortable with one or two agents within that class as my first-line therapy for hypertension.
What about the combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib, either those two agents just together or with chemotherapy, particularly in the patient who has EGFR mutation or a non-smoker?
I think that the benefits of erlotinib in patients with epidermal growth factor receptor mutations are clear, and I don't know that the addition of bevacizumab to erlotinib makes a significant improvement in either the response rate, time to progression, or overall survival. And as such, I steer away from using bevacizumab in that setting, and I use erlotinib as a single agent there. I think that in the patient who maybe has some clinical characteristics that suggest they're going to respond, or in a patient that you're treating upfront with carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, it's reasonable to add on erlotinib to that. I generally, in an off-study situation, have not been treating patients with erlotinib and bevacizumab either up front or in the second or third line.
So in the patient who you do start erlotinib, they have a mutation, let's say they have a response, and then they progress. How do you manage that?
So this is a very important issue, I think, and I think that one that we don't really know the answer to. I think that the direct analogy is a patient with a HER2-positive breast cancer who responds to Herceptin and then goes on to progress. As you know, the standard approach to those patients without evidence from a randomized trial is to continue the Herceptin and add chemotherapy onto that. We actually looked at this situation with a relatively small trial where we took 10 patients with what we defined as acquired resistance to erlotinib or gefitinib. And those patients had all been on erlotinib or gefitinib for more than 6 months. They had all had a response to therapy. If we couldn't document that response to therapy, we just made sure their tumor had an EGFR mutation. So we took this relatively select group of patients, and then we did all the scans on them. We did a CAT scan of the chest with contrast. We did a PET scan, and then we stopped their erlotinib or gefitinib because that's the standard approach to patients who've progressed on one therapy is to stop that therapy. So we did that for 3 weeks. We stopped their erlotinib or gefitinib, and then we scanned them again to see what happened. And as you'd expect, most of the tumors grew and their FDG avidity also rose on the PET scan. because they were all progressing beforehand, so it's reasonable to presume that they would continue to progress off the treatment. But then we restarted gefitinib or erlotinib and left them on that therapy for another 3 weeks and then reassessed. And what we found, somewhat surprisingly, is that all their tumors stabilized. You know, we'd used fancy volumetric CT measurements. We used conventional unidimensional CT measurements. We used two-dimensional measurements, and we looked at PET scan. And by all measures, these tumors stabilized in their growth rate and their FDG uptake on PET scan. And so that, for us, really suggests that these patients are continuing to benefit from erlotinib therapy, and that has made, for us, the standard of care to continue erlotinib and add on additional chemotherapy to erlotinib.
What about adding on chemotherapy plus bevacizumab?
I think it's a perfectly reasonable approach. We have done that in some situations. Certainly, many therapies can be given in that setting. Pemetrexed can be added to bevacizumab and erlotinib relatively safely, as can most chemotherapies, and I think it's a perfectly reasonable approach. But I think, just to get back to the question of what you're supposed to do in that situation, I think that our study suggests that that's what we should do, and our experience with HER2-positive breast cancer suggests that we should continue erlotinib, but it really needs to be proved in a randomized trial. And we're getting a trial such as that off the ground now, where patients who are progressing after initial response to erlotinib are then randomized to either pemetrexed alone or pemetrexed with erlotinib to try to sort out whether that treatment past progression is a wise thing to do or whether it's just something that we sense is the right thing to do.
You know, this issue of continuation of biologics on disease progression, you hear in a lot of different tumors and a lot of people talking about the trastuzumab example. And you hear a lot of it in bevacizumab, you know, rebound, increase in VEGF. I've heard more about that, I think, in breast cancer than anything else. What do we know about that issue in terms of continuation of bevacizumab in lung cancer?
I think that you're absolutely right. There is a lot of talk about it. We, again, don't have any data in this area for patients with lung cancer. We've heard a lot about the idea of continuing bevacizumab in colorectal cancer from the BRIGHT database, as well as in the breast cancer world. But I think that we don't have that data for lung cancer, and my partners and I all generally discontinue bevacizumab at the time of progressive disease and move on to the next therapy.
Getting back to the cetuximab story, what do we know about cetuximab and other markers, and specifically FISH for EGFR? I think there was a study reported looking at that.
Roy Herbst published a paper in the JCO this year demonstrating that using the FISH positivity, you can predict patients that are more likely to respond to cetuximab. So I think that that may help to expand the use of molecular testing in that setting, especially with a treatment like cetuximab, where you have a relatively modest benefit for the overall unselected group of patients. If you can select those patients just a little bit better using something like FISH, that will improve the likelihood of response. It'll make patients a bit more happy to take this drug, I think, and we'll see better responses and better improvements in overall survival.
I want to ask you about a couple of papers that you were part of that were published in the JNCI this year. First, a study looking at bronchoalveolar carcinoma, and specifically in terms of predictors of response to erlotinib. Can you talk about that paper?
Right. So this is Vince Miller's paper in the JCO this year. And in that trial, we took 100 patients. And this is a multi-center trial carried out with Vanderbilt and MD Anderson Cancer Center. We took 100 patients who had, whether they had pure bronchoalveolar carcinoma or adenocarcinoma with bronchoalveolar cell features. And, you know, that's really the more common thing, is these adenocarcinomas with bronchoalveolar cell features. So we took those patients with, they had to have tissue to go on this trial. And then we treated them all with erlotinib single agent at the conventional dose. And what we found is that there was a 22% response rate in the overall patient population. And then we did a variety of molecular markers like EGFR mutation, EGFR gene copy number, and KRAS mutation. And in the 18 patients who had EGFR mutations, we saw a response rate of about 80%. And of the 18 patients with KRAS mutations, we saw a response rate of 0%. None of those patients responded. And then looking at EGFR gene copy number, patients with an elevated number of copies of EGFR did have an improved progression-free survival and response rate. Then we did a multivariate analysis looking at all these factors, and the only factor that came out as a predictor of response rate was EGFR mutation.
So what's the message?
So I think the number one message is that erlotinib is an effective agent in patients with bronchoalveolar cell carcinoma or adenocarcinoma with bronchoalveolar cell features. And the second is that the best predictor of response in this setting is EGFR mutation.
Another paper that you were a part of looked at weekly nab-paclitaxel in non-small cell. We've seen a lot of studies and interest in nab in breast cancer, but I haven't heard too much about it in lung cancer, although you would think that taxanes or paclitaxel certainly very commonly utilized. Can you talk about sort of the background of that study and what you found?
Sure. This is a paper in the JCO with Rizvi, R-I-Z-V-I, as the first author. And in that paper, this was actually a phase 1-2 trial of nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel. And after initially identifying the MTD, then we treated patients with the MTD of nab-paclitaxel. And it was a weekly administration schedule. In that trial, we found that the response rate, these were all patients who had not previously been treated with taxanes or any chemotherapy, actually. In this study, we found the response rate with single-agent nab-paclitaxel was 30%, so really a good solid response rate. And the overall survivals are perfectly reasonable for upfront treatment for non-small cell lung cancer. So I think with regard to the overall development strategy of nab-paclitaxel, they clearly have done a lot more work in the breast cancer arena, and the randomized trial demonstrating somewhat superior efficacy to Taxol was published in that arena. In lung cancer, we've done a lot more work to combine it with other therapies. There's a fair amount of data combining with carboplatin. There's also a carboplatin nab-paclitaxel bevacizumab trial. And, you know, I think the push hasn't been there, and I don't think we have a randomized trial ongoing to get that drug into patients with lung cancer, though I think it's clearly a good drug and the generally understood benefits as compared to conventional solvent taxanes is apparent. You know, the absence of hypersensitivity reactions in our trial really says a lot when you're administering a taxane to a patient population who didn't get any steroids whatsoever. I think it's a real nice thing.
Anything in terms of SPARC and non-small cell, there's these speculations that somehow this might be related to being more efficacious. You mentioned those hints in breast cancer. What about lung cancer?
Yeah, we don't have that data in lung cancer. I think that that tissue problem is, again, rearing its head, limiting our ability to test that hypothesis in lung cancer.
Another thing I want to ask you about was a paper, when I look back at ASCO, certainly the FLEX data got a lot of interest. But another study I heard a lot of people talking about looked at pemetrexed as maintenance therapy. Can you talk about what they looked at there and what you think it means?
Right. In that trial, patients were initially treated with a platinum-based doublet, and then after they completed therapy, I believe it was 4 or 6 cycles, they were randomized to either no therapy or pemetrexed as a maintenance treatment. And in that trial, they observed certainly an improvement in progression-free survival. And while the overall survival analysis is still very early, there's a suggestion that there's an improvement in overall survival. The big problem in that analysis, of course, is of the patients who were not randomized to pemetrexed therapy, what patients got? Did they go on to a second-line chemotherapy? And it turns out that the number of patients who went on to second-line therapy was below 50%. And as such, it makes it hard in my mind to compare those groups of patients. And I don't quite understand why those patients didn't go on to a second-line therapy, what the factors were that were present, whether the patients had rapidly progressive disease or the physicians involved weren't amenable to second-line therapy. It's not clear to me.
So in terms of, you know, impacting your clinical practice?
I think it's still a little bit too early to use pemetrexed as a maintenance therapy at this time. I think we need a little bit more data before we can get there.
What about the issue of pemetrexed in the upfront setting? There was a paper in the JCO that was published recently in editorial by Larry Einhorn looking at the issue of, you know, tissue histology and choice of chemotherapy and specifically the question of pemetrexed and adenocarcinoma.
Right. I think that this one actually has changed the way I practice. And that's a paper by Scagliotti in the JCO. And that is the largest randomized trial in patients with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer upfront treatment ever published. And they randomized patients to either gemcitabine cisplatin or pemetrexed cisplatin. In the analysis of the overall patient population, there was no difference in overall survival or progression-free survival by a treatment arm. But when they did a pre-specified subset analysis looking at histology, among the patients with non-squamous histology, and particularly the adenocarcinomas, those patients did better when they received the cisplatin pemetrexed as compared to cisplatin gemcitabine. That's led me to use cisplatin pemetrexed as a first-line therapy in patients with adenocarcinoma. And then you combine this data with safety data that has been presented at ASCO in the past by Jyoti Patel that demonstrates that cisplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab is safe. And I think that that makes it clear that it's a reasonable thing to treat with a platinum-based doublet with pemetrexed and bevacizumab.
What about carbo as opposed to cis?
I think it's a reasonable change to use carboplatin instead of cisplatin. And as such, I think carboplatin, pemetrexed is a reasonable choice as well.
So right now, in a non-protocol situation, when you have a patient who you want to give Bev to, generally, what are they going to receive with it?
I think it depends on the histology, but my top three, as anybody in the world would be, is carboplatin paclitaxel Bev, cisplatin pemetrexed Bev, and then I still do occasionally gemcitabine cisplatin bevacizumab.
So why not carbo pemetrexed Bev?
I think you could do that. I think that I have no objection to that. It's just I try to give cisplatin when I can.
Last thing I was going to ask you about is you were talking earlier about looking at agents that combine anti-EGFR and VEGF activity. What are some of the ones out there that are being tested in clinical trials?
So XL647 is probably the drug that's furthest along with the most phase 2 data. BIBW2992 also is an irreversible EGFR inhibitor that has some activity against VEGF. And then there's also HKI272, which is a EGFR and HER2 drug, and that's actually being developed more in the breast cancer arena now than in the lung cancer arena. And those are sort of the main ones that come to mind.
What about 647 for vandetanib?
Yeah, so that's certainly been the drug of discussion for actually a number of years. Unfortunately, we don't have strong clinical trial data to suggest that it works better than, say, just EGFR blockade alone, as with gefitinib or erlotinib. And certainly we don't have data that says it's any better than giving an EGFR drug such as erlotinib with a VEGF drug like bevacizumab. So at this point, I don't think that we can really say that vandetanib is better, and there are a few more trials out there to go before we can really say that it doesn't have a role in lung cancer, but I think at this point it does not.